Good afternoon, and thanks for listening to the Smoke and Mirror Show. This is Rob Boyd, your host, and I'm here with my co-host, Steve Skidmore, and a very special guest, Jennifer Ruby. Steve, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm ugly, but I'm still on top of the dirt.
Excellent, excellent.
I ain't Jennifer. Bragging. That's not bragging rights. That's just fact. No opinion, right. Just simple fact.
Jennifer, how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing really well. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you joining
folks,
us.
Absolutely. If you don't mind me jumping in here, folks, last week, and thank you for tuning in last week. Last week we had Pat Baker on, and I know that we left a lot of information wide open. Part of that was happenstance. Part of that was intentional. Today we have Ms. Ruby on, and if you listeners will recollect from last week, we introduced you to land patents. We also introduced you to the concept of changing your political status. Now, political status aside for today's show, we're going to focus on the land patent issue. What we did not cover last week that we will today is process and expectations. Everybody wants to know, okay, we've got all this information, now how do we put it to use? That's why we've got Jennifer on today. Jennifer has really been through the mill. I mean, the powers that be have hammered on you from the day you popped your head out, haven't they, Jennifer?
Absolutely.
Well, let's get a brief introduction to who Jennifer Ruby is and how you came about to studying and implementing this land patent issue or information.
Well, my background is an interior designer, and so that is kind of right brain thinking. And law, of course, is very left brain analytical. So it was very much a challenge for me to switch my research topics. But one day, my property tax was like, I don't know, it was like $400 or something like that, 400 and something. And the very next day, it had more than doubled. It was over 100%.
Wow.
And that is actually illegal. And when you have a homestead exemption in place, they are only lawfully allowed to go up 10% a year. And so that was quite a shock. Well, I tried to, you know, protest it, and they wouldn't do anything about it. And so I kept thinking, well, you know, surely there is some way that I can affect some change here, because they don't have any interest in my land. They've never even mowed the lawn once, you know, much less given any valuable consideration into this thing. And so that's when I decided I was going to start researching land patents and land titles.
Good. So you met Pat Baker how? I take it that Pat Baker was your primary and first source for patent information. Is that correct?
I believe it was, yes.
Okay.
A friend of mine said that even though I had listened to him on Deborah's show and Randy and Eddie's show,
Rule of Law Radio,
right, that they had actually gotten a hold of him and talked to him in person and or over the phone or whatever. And so I said, well, you know, I need to talk to him because I've got some questions. So we began our friendship and have been pretty close friends now for several years. And
okay, then you met Pat very much the same way I did. I used to be a broadcaster on Rule of Law Radio, and Pat used to be the guy out in West Texas that was literally hanging off a water tower to get a signal.
Right.
I mean, he lives way out in the middle of absolutely nothing, and he likes
right.
it that way.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
We need to go visit him, by the way.
Say it again?
I said we need to go visit him sometime, actually.
Absolutely, yeah. Let's make plans on doing that. So once you learn some of the benefits of land patents, there being really no detriment unless a good fight you consider to be a detriment. But you're definitely going to get a good fight out of this.
Right.
But when you learned that you do have relief in this, where did you first turn for substantive information on the issue of land patents?
Well, I have been listening to a fella that is Rob Ryder. And one of the first things he mentioned was that land titles are pretty much a uncompleted contract. And what he was saying was that in any type of a legal contract, you have a offer, and then you have a consideration, and you have
acceptance.
Acceptance and then consideration. And he said that basically all of these land titles in the last, 60 or 80 years have been such that the offer is made and the person that is the grantor, he signs the contract as offering you this land, and his signature is notarized. But you never sign the deed that you are accepting the offer, which leaves this contract totally unconsummated.
Gotcha.
And so I started thinking about that, and I thought, okay, how can I do that? So then I thought I would like to amend my deed. Well, the county clerk said, oh, no, you can't do it that way. And so I kind of argued with her a little bit, and she says, no, you probably are going to need to do a correction of deed. So I tried to do a correction of deed, and I'll tell you what, they just came down on me like nobody's business. They did not like that, and they got the district attorney involved. And he kept telling me, no, you don't want to do that. That's only for banks. That's for governments and things like that. You don't need to do that. And I said, but I want to do that. And he kept saying, no, you don't need to do that. And I kept saying, but I want to do that. And finally, I came up with all the statutes that stated that I had the right to correct my deed and to acknowledge and accept that we were accepting what was being offered. And finally, he got so frustrated with me, and he goes, okay, just come on up and record it. And I said, thank you. I will be up to record it. And that is one of the first things that happened. And then we had the next battle with trying to get the acceptance, the acknowledgement and acceptance of the land patent, and doing a declaration of that. And he like that.
It sounds like we jumped ahead a little bit.
Okay.
The process. Let's first go back a little bit to last week. There's two types of patents you can get in Texas. Now, the other 49 states, don't know. But in Texas, you can go to the state of Texas, the corporate state of Texas, and have new patent issued. The first thing you lose there is your water and mineral rights.
Correct.
Okay. Or there's this other patent that's been there since the mid-1800s that nobody is using right now. This was issued by the Republic of Texas back before the state ever existed. That patent is still there, but nobody is using it. The heirs cannot claim it because they have sold it, subdivided it, chopped it, diced it up. They no longer have a claim to it, but you have documentation. If you have purchased land or purchased a house lot or a house with a lot, you've got what's called a deed. The deed is an instrument evidencing the conveyance of property or land.
Correct.
Now, what property? Well, that property would be outlined by your plat map. The meets and bounds on your plat map is what property that you're trying to accept the existing patent on.
Correct.
So that is part of the key process to bringing forward that original patent that I wanted to delve into. What documents do you need? What kind of foundation do you need to set? How do you set the stage to introduce these documents? Where do you go to get these documents? What type of documents do you need to complete the process of securing your 1800s patent here in Texas?
Okay. The first thing that you need to do is have a meets and bounds
survey.
Could be your survey.
Yes, you need the survey, and then you need your plat map. And there, the plat is actually the drawing of everything, whereas the survey is the description, you know, so many degrees this way, so many feet that way, that type of thing.
Gotcha.
And
now, Pat actually, excuse me just a moment, Pat actually said that he started a an abstract.
Right. Well, that's your chain of title.
Did you do an abstract on yours?
Yes. I've got the complete unbroken chain of title all the way back to the severance of the sovereign.
Okay.
And that's
part of the
process.
That's
what an abstract is. Yeah.
Okay.
It's the abstract company will do it for you, but they want like 500 and up. Even if you just have a couple links that you are missing, they have a minimum fee. And they have pretty well stopped doing this. You have a real difficult time finding an abstract company anymore. And the reason for that is because they are in the business of selling you title insurance. And if you can prove that you have an unbroken, totally clean chain of title all the way back to the severance of the sovereign, then guess what? You don't need to buy title insurance company.
Yeah, you have no need for their services.
Right.
Gotcha.
So,
yeah, a lot of
you
the,
can do it yourself,
were,
but it does take some
companies.
Time.
Say that again, Rob.
A lot of the abstract companies were partners or subsidiaries of title companies, and that's why they're all going away, because the title companies have no interest in giving you peace of mind on your deed.
Correct.
They want you to pay for their insurance.
Yeah.
You only need
pay for our protection.
If there's an unsurety out there.
Right. Okay, so you get an abstract done, then you need to identify what property it is that you're accepting a patent on, and that would bring us back to where I interrupted. That would be your the meets and bounds in your plat map.
Right.
Okay.
And that actually ties it to the real soil of the land that you are claiming.
Gotcha.
And it's your part and parcel of the original land grant.
Okay.
Because you're not claiming the whole thing. That would be fraud. Other people are living there. But you have a part and parcel, and you are the assignee of that part and parcel as demonstrated through your chain of title.
Gotcha. Now, you're going to need an instrument evidencing the conveyance of this property, are you not?
Yes.
That would be a deed of some sort.
Right. That would be your original deed that you are doing an acknowledgement and acceptance of, and maybe doing a correction of the title, because they don't seem to want to allow you to sign it at the closing table.
Mm-hmm.
However, you have like a 3-day window after.
Well, there's
the
not
closing.
Even a space. There's not even. I went back and looked at my deed. There's not even a space for me to sign.
Yeah.
They just conveniently left that out.
That's right.
Imagine that.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so far we've gotten the documents that you're going to need would be abstract, a survey, a deed, a plat map. Now you need a copy of the original patent. Is that correct?
Correct. And you
certified.
Get that in Texas. Yes, you need a certified copy. In Texas, you need that to get that at the General Land Office in Austin.
1700 North Congress, just 3 blocks north of the Capitol Dome.
Right.
Now, you can go into that. If you're in Texas, you can go into that building on the ground floor, turn to your left, and look for something called archives.
Right.
There are a lot of helpful people in there because they don't see public very much. They don't have much interaction. So just grab one of those bats off the rafters and say, here's what I need.
And they really know their software pretty well and are very helpful for the most part. Even if you don't know, you know, a whole lot about it, they can look you up even just with your address. But most people will take the
plat map.
Not the plat map, but the survey, and it'll say abstract something or other, and it'll give you the original patent grantee name, and that's your abstract. And so when you go to that land office, you can tell them, you know, I'm in this abstract with this patent, and they'll look it up that way, or sometimes they'll just look it up from your regular address and try to determine which survey you're on.
What little piece of dirt belongs to you?
Right.
Okay. So we've gotten an abstract, a deed, a survey, a plat map, and a copy of the original land patent. Those are five documents, and all of which need to be certified.
Right.
So for your deed, your deed and your plat map may not necessarily be in public record.
A lot of times they're not, especially if you live in a subdivision.
Right.
They have totally changed it to block and lot number.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more of a statutory description. It's color of law. It is not actually tied to the soil. And that's what you need to have, is something that's actually tied to the soil.
Right.
That would be your plat map.
Right, with a meets and bounds description.
Yeah, okay. So once you've gotten all of these documents certified and in order, what's the next step?
Well, you need to actually do some sort of a declaration.
Okay.
And what you're doing is you are not issuing yourself a patent. That is not at all what you're doing. You are acknowledging
that there is... issued.
Right, that there was an original land patent or land grant, and that you, through the chain of title that is unbroken with no tax sales to break it, that you are the assignee of that original land grant. And so as the assignee, you have rights, and they have duties to you.
Now we can see the landscape starting to change.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is when your public servants become your servants instead of your masters.
Right.
Okay. We introduced our listening audience to your website last week, and that would be landgrantpatent.org. landgrantpatent.org. Now, do you have any examples of the documentation that you have used on your website to bring
Yes.
forward your... Okay. Can you guide us to that?
Yes. In the chain of title tab, there's...
That would be the second one down under home.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Land title and deeds.
At the bottom, there's a link that says, how can you research and document your chain of title abstract yourself? And there's a Word document there that you can download. And it gives you kind of a form that you can go from this person to that person. And then from that person back to this other person. See what I mean? And you have
Perfect.
A way of just kind of... documenting the entire chain of title using that form.
Excellent. So you don't necessarily need an abstract company or a title
company
to do an abstract.
Not if you're able to do it yourself. However, you'll find that a lot of times there's a lot of ins and outs that are – I'm helping a friend of mine do some of her own research, and what she's running into is that these people had large families. And so when somebody died, it would go to the heirs of like five different people. Well, sometimes the land had been transferred into the trustee's name. Or if it was a woman, sometimes it would be in her trustee's name. So even though the land had been transferred to the daughter, it wouldn't be in her name. And so that gets really confusing when you're only looking at names in these, you know, land grant books that they've got in the county recorder's office.
Mm-hmm.
It gets kind of confusing. And so sometimes you have to work from the front, like from the most current, your deed, you have to work back, and then sometimes you start from the back and you work forward and hope that you can meet in the middle somewhere.
It
can be very challenging, and it does take a lot of time. None of this is something that's just, you know, handed to you on a silver platter. It just isn't. Unless you have plenty of money that you can just fork out and have somebody do it for you.
Yeah, and who's got that? I've heard it said many times that nothing good comes easy.
Right. Nothing of value is handed to you, that's for sure.
That's right. You got to fight for it. Now, once you have drafted, now let's add some clarity. Your declaration would be in an affidavit form. Would that be correct?
Yes. And it can be in a declaration with an affidavit at the end.
Okay. Now, just for peace of mind, a declaration, legally speaking, a declaration and an affidavit can be the same but are not necessarily. It depends on how they're drafted.
Right.
So, you know, along with any other information that you're going to hear on this broadcast, please, please, please do your own research.
Right.
We are now. Granted, Jennifer's been there, done that. None of us here are the end all to be all. If we knew the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, our hands would not be upon the Bible. Our names would be in it. So, you know, what I'm saying is never take, particularly in legal matters, never take anybody's word for it. What we're trying to give you here is a reasonable basis upon which you can start your own research.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. So with that said, in your declaration, what was it that you were conveying? What message was it that you were putting out in your declaration, Jennifer?
Basically, what I did was I put in there that I was accepting the original land grant. Let me see. I'm looking at mine.
And there's a file number on that. Is that
right.
Correct? The GLO
right.
File number?
Right. What we're doing is we are declaring that we are accepting the assignment of the original land patent. And you have a land patent number, you have a volume number, you have a certificate number, you have a file number, you have an abstract number, you have the county district number, and what type of patent it is. In mine, it was a first class headright.
Ah, nice.
There's second class headrights. There's third class headrights. There's warrant and bounty patents. There's mm-hmm. different types. There's school patents.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to, you know, describe it a little bit. So I put for the originally held a couple thousand acres here to the original patentee, to his heirs and to his assigns forever. And I put originally issued on a certain date, and I acknowledge the Lord as being the original grantee. And through the office of the steward, which was the president of the republic, because we are all stewards before the Lord. And so, and then I'm saying that we updated it through the president that was sitting in office at that time.
Okay.
And when you do these things, it's better if you can actually spell out dates. So I actually spelled out 2011.
Instead of using the numerical.
Right, because the written word always trumps the
absolutely,
you know, just this actual date put on there.
Yes, it shows clearer intent.
Right.
Okay.
And there can be no mistake if you do it that way.
Correct.
And in mine, I did it nunc pro tunc, back to the original date of the land grant.
Okay.
And that way it sucks it up to the date that that land was divested of all right and title by the sovereign.
Okay.
And so I am claiming all the rights, privileges, and immunities that belong to the grantee on that date.
Okay.
Makes sense. Yeah.
So once you've gotten all of these documents together, you've drafted your acceptance, you've gotten all of your certified documents in order, now what? File them into the public record?
Yes, and that can be sometimes a challenge because...
Problematic?
They do not want to allow you. You know, it's kind of like when you possess as your property the goose that lays a golden egg, you don't really want to let that golden goose go.
Right.
And that's the problem that you're running into, is that the county recorder is not going to necessarily work with you to cut down the amount of money that comes into the county. And so it's really kind of a challenge. And in my situation, the district attorney got involved, and he sent all of my paperwork, both my patent update as well as my confirmatory patent. He sent everything to the attorney general's office three times.
Fantastic.
And so the attorney general at that time was Greg Abbott, who is now the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And in all three cases, his office told him to, you know, stand down, that everything was legal, and told him to allow me to come up and record it. And so I did. And now that we're having issues, you know, with getting things recognized, you know, and let go as it should be.
When you say let go, let's define let go. You're trying to remove your piece of land from the tax rolls. Is that what you mean by let go?
Yes, because it's not really a matter of the tax, the tax assessor, so much as that is a what would they call that? That is a symptom of the problem, that they have not recognized that they do not have any authority on your land. It's a symptom of the problem. It's not the problem itself. It's a symptom that they have not accepted this.
Okay.
And so I've been working with the land commissioner, and I have a letter here from his attorney, and his attorney has, you know, said in writing in this letter that the state of Texas has been divested of all title, and they don't have any interest in the land. But the county seems to not get that through their head.
Well, the county would be a subsidiary division of the state. So if the state has no claim, the county can't have a claim. Nemo dat quod non habet. No man gives what he does not have. If the state has no right and interest, they cannot convey any right and interest to the county. Nor can the county convey that to the city, nor can the city convey that to any homeowners association or anything like that. So if the state doesn't have a claim, nobody under the state has a claim. Now, this is the one of the problems that you're having is you cannot get the county to basically say the same thing that the state has already said. Would that be fair to say?
That would be fair to say.
Okay.
Well, looking at your situation, they just doubled your taxes. So let's go back to Pat for just a few minutes. I think he'd mentioned that he was paying like $37, $38 a year in taxes. Yeah, so what? We're not going to miss that. But you, on the other hand, you went from $400 to $800 or better. So now there's a bigger stake in the claim, and that's annual revenues that they don't want to let go. So let's suffice it to say that the more your property taxes are, the more fight the county's going to put.
True. And it really is a huge problem because people are losing their homes left and right. I was talking to a lady the other day who lives in Katy off of Fry Road in a very, very nice house. Mm-hmm. And her house is totally paid off. And she still owes over $2,400. Let's see, what did she say? $2,400 a month, I think she said, because it was a huge, huge bill at the end of the year. And I told her, I said, that is like a house payment, you know, on a house like this. I mean, I was shocked. And the problem is that they are trying to transfer our financial resources from our pockets to theirs.
And who is they? Who is
the
they?
Government.
Okay.
The government. I mean, have you noticed the huge amount of reverse mortgages?
Oh, yeah.
Being advertised all over?
And oh, yeah.
The problem is they do not tell the people, they do not disclose to the people that the minute your husband dies, you literally have less than 90 days and you have to be out of your house.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are going to kick you out and put you on the street the minute your husband dies. Mm-hmm. And they always do it in the husband's name because he usually typically, statistically, dies first. So they do not put it in both of your names. And if they do, then the amount of money that they're willing to loan is significantly decreased.
Mm.
So there's a real conspiracy to, you know, get people to use their titles to their land as collateral for loans and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so that they can default you. Pat was telling me the other day that
it's a land grab.
He's been paying his payments every month on time. And for the last 2 months, he has been getting a notice that they never got one of them. And he's like, excuse me, you know, I've been paying consistently. And, you know, why should you have to pay registered mail every month just to make sure that they credit your account properly?
You shouldn't. If you do, then over the time of that contract, they should owe you the accumulation of all the mailing.
Right. But I told him, I said, what they're trying to do is default you, so that they can, you know, repossess the land. And he said, yeah, he understood that completely.
Mm-hmm. It's a redistribution of wealth.
Right.
Through the grabbing of land. That's where all of our wealth resides, by the way, folks. If you don't own land, you have no wealth. All you have is debt. And it's
right.
on your back, and it's on the backs of your children and grandchildren unless we do something about it. Now, how do you fix that? You got to own something, and you can't own land, the most important commodity that is available to mankind. You cannot own land by deed. You simply, if you have land by deed, you simply have possession of land with ownership interest. That is not the same as ownership.
Right.
So when you, let's get back to the process. When you, when you've gathered all your documents, they're all certified and you've drafted your declaration or acceptance, and you file everything into the public record, eventually you will. Now, you're like you did, Jennifer, you had a lot of hurdles to jump, but you eventually got the county clerk to file your documents.
Yes.
Now, do you allow somebody, anybody, enough time? After this is put into the public record, everybody has constructive notice. Anybody can go to the public record and check it out. Now, you're going to allow anybody and everybody who might have a stake in a claim on your land to come forward and say, hey, I saw this in the public record, and I've done some research, and I've got a stake on that land there. Part of that's mine. I'm entitled to some of that. Am I correct in saying that it would be fair, after putting it into the public record, that you give an amount of time for anybody to step forward and pronounce their claim?
You have to do that. In every, you know, to do or to receive equity, you have to give equity. And part of that is public notice.
Maxims of equity.
Right. You have to give public notice. So once I filed this into the county record and recorded it there, what I did was I took out a public notice in the legal section of our newspaper.
Okay.
And I ran it for 2 weeks, and you may want to run it for longer, but it's very expensive. But you just go ahead and you do that, and then when you get done with your time that you've run it in the paper, and you have to give them like 30 days notice so that they have 30 days to come and make a claim.
Them being anybody,
have,
correct?
Right, anybody, but they have to actually bring their evidence that they have a superior claim to yours
mm-hmm.
on your land. You're right. not claiming your neighbor's land. You're not claiming other people's land in that patent. You're only claiming the meets and bounds to your piece of property.
That which has been conveyed to you.
Right. And you have proof of the conveyance, and you have the meets and bounds,
mm-hmm.
and you have your chain of title. And so now you have a legal notice giving everybody an opportunity to come and to rebut your notice, and they have 30 days to do that.
Did you happen to send a copy of that to the property tax office?
Oh yes, oh yes.
And what was
they definitely were noticed? They ignored it.
Huh. Interesting.
What happened though was that when
acceptance.
Tacit acquiescence. So what I did was I went ahead and got all of this noticed in the county newspaper. And then the county newspaper in the legal department, they give you an affidavit of publishing with tear sheets. So I put my affidavit of publishing, my two tear sheets together, and a copy of the notice.
What
and
is
then
a tear
I did,
sheet?
A tear sheet is an actual Xerox copy of the newspaper article itself.
Okay.
So it was the legal notice that was in the newspaper.
Gotcha.
And so they sent me like a Xerox of both of those and gave me a copy of the original, which, you know, eventually is going to fall apart. But anyway,
mm-hmm.
They gave me that and then the affidavit of publishing.
Okay.
And so then I wrote a confirmatory patent. and it was a confirmation of patent instrument, and I wrote that up and put that as one of the exhibits. And then I did a common law homestead declaration in as opposed to a statutory application for homestead exemption. See, all of these things
Before we go any further, let's discuss the legal ramifications behind the word application. When you apply, you are making a plea or begging someone else to conform to your will. This is my wish. Would you please do this? Now, if the other side says, no, we're not going to do that, you're pretty much left with no remedy. The reason I bring this up is that if I own something, let's say I own a pickup truck outright, it's paid off, title's in my name. And if I let somebody like a neighbor borrow that pickup truck, I shouldn't have to go back to that neighbor and say, hey, can I have my truck back? No, I have the keys. This is my truck. I'm taking it back. I own it. I am in control here. Look at land in the same way. Why, if you own something, would you go ask someone else permission to do something with it?
Right.
That is a slave mentality, not a master mentality.
Right.
Once we begin this path, we have got to go through a paradigm shift. We are no longer the servant to the master. We are the master. They are the servant. We don't ask our servants to do a damn thing. We demand these things of our servants. And so long as they are within the law, our servants must comply.
Right.
Would you agree?
Yes.
But they don't always, do they?
No.
More times than not.
Yeah, exactly. So you've been doing, when did you first start filing paperwork to secure your patent?
In February, I believe it was February of 2011. And at that time, all of my property taxes were totally caught up to date. Everything was on the up and up. And they knew that I had given them notice that my land title had been perfected. And okay, being perfected, it goes from color of law to a lawful title, because it's been perfected by your acknowledgement and your acceptance and your stipulations of all of the different aspects of what you were perfecting. And so they were given notice both publicly in the newspaper. They were given notice in the county recorder's office. They were given copies themselves because I mailed them copies. Then they were given a copy of the...
Let me pause you right there. There's a difference there, a legal difference. When you put something in the paper or put something in the county records, that is constructive notice. Actual notice is when you send a copy of those filings to a party who you think might claim an interest, such as the tax office. So
right,
you gave them not only constructive notice, you gave them actual notice.
Right.
I'm sure you did this registered mail.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry
and
to interrupt.
And then I did a confirmatory patent and gave them copies of that. And at that time, I started doing open records requests. And I asked them to send me a copy of all of the properties in the county that the county claimed an interest to. And they sent me a CD-ROM with a huge spreadsheet and all these different properties, anywhere from the jail, the library, all the different county buildings, a county courthouse, all of the different easements and properties that the county had title to. And then they sent me a answer and told me that they did not know who had an equitable interest in my land.
Well, when you were going through that litany of things that they owned, I noticed the absence of privately owned land.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why the county appraiser can go on to commercial property and inspect it and inventory things and whatever for property tax, but they have to ask permission of a private owner's to come onto their property. They're not allowed just to walk into your home or whatever.
And if you do not grant them permission and they enter your property anyway, what is that called?
Trespass.
Wow, it's two things if you've brought forward your patent, isn't it?
Yep.
That would be a criminal trespass and a patent infringement.
Yes.
Ouch. Okay, so the stakes are the benefits on our end, the landowner's end, they're increasing, as where the detriment on the tax office and the powers that be's end, that is increasing.
Yes.
Okay. Now we can see a power shift here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me shift gears just right quick. I had something in my head for several years, and that's NAFTA. I'm sure most of our listening audience is familiar with NAFTA. There is or was plans on the table for a NAFTA highway to come up from Mexico to go through Texas and through the rest of the United States on into Canada. This thing was slated to be a couple of miles wide, at least.
Mm-hmm.
But if that would be taken by eminent, the land that highway would be placed on would be taken by eminent domain. How do you stop eminent domain?
By showing your chain of title and your superior title to theirs.
You perfect your land patent. Now, imagine if all along the southern border, the border between Mexico and the United States, if there was a solid band of patented land, they could not run their highway, period. It would shut the NAFTA project down cold, dead in its tracks, in theory.
It's interesting. Yeah, well, it's interesting, too, because right now I have a friend who has a piece of property in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and they are trying to do eminent domain on it. And he is not an attorney. He has just spent months studying my webpage, and he has been doing his due diligence and writing his own notices and motions and documents and just putting in all the court cases and everything. And he has held them off now for months. And usually they just come in and say, you know, we own your property as of yesterday and you don't have anything to say about it. But because he has a complete unbroken chain of title from now all the way back to before Pennsylvania even became a state, before William Penn, the property that he has the patent on came from five Indian tribes. And they cannot figure out what to do with him because...
Good.
You know, when you look at Black's Law and you look at what it says about eminent domain, it talks about the power to take private property for public use by the state, municipalities, and private persons or corporations authorized to exercise the functions of public character. And then it states in here that the right of eminent domain is the right of that state through its regular organization to reassert, either temporarily or permanently, its dominion over any portion of the soil of the state on account of public exigency and for the public good. But what happens is if they never had the property in their name and their title, if they never had possession of that property before, then
they can't get it.
They can't reassert what they never had to begin with. They can't resume what they never had Zoom to start with.
It goes back to that legal maxim, nemo dat quod non habet. That's in English, that means no man gives what he does not have.
That's right.
Nor can you exercise a right that you don't have. And it's not a right. The state does not have rights. The state has privileges granted by us.
Right. There was a congressman who is named Stephen A. Douglas. A quote that he had published in the public record of the Congressional Globe, 31st Congress, first session, June 26, 1850, page 848. And it said, "We have never acted upon the principle that ownership of soil is an essential ingredient of sovereignty. The United States government has never held one foot of land by virtue of its sovereignty. Sovereignty was not the title by which we have claimed or held one acre of public lands. We hold the lands by virtue of the same title that an individual possesses his own estate. The government holds its lands by deeds of conveyance."
Well, that makes perfect sense. Let's go back and look at what government actually is supposed to be, a government of the people, by the people, for the people. So the government is a public body, or should be. We know now that it's a private corporate body, but if it is a de jure government, it is made up of the people, by the people, and for the people.
Yes.
If that be the case, then only people can hold land, not government. They can't. Let's say some government entity came across a land patent and said, "Hey, I want to bring this forward." They can't do what we can do.
No.
They cannot do what we can do. And this, I believe, is why the tax office stands mute when you give them actual notice of your the perfection of your patent. It's because they are forbidden to have a claim in it.
It's interesting. In the United States Supreme Court records, volume 12A, on states, territories, and possessions, on page 10 of subsection 5, it has a quote here from the McCullough versus State court case. And it says, "The sovereignty of a state extends to everything which exists by its own authority or is introduced by its permission, but does it extend to those means which are employed by Congress to carry into execution powers conferred on that body by the people of the United States." And the answer to that is, we think it's demonstrable that it does not. Those powers were not given by the people of a single state. They are given by the people of the United States to a government whose laws, made in pursuance of the Constitution, are declared to be supreme. Consequently, the people of a single state cannot confer a sovereignty which will extend over them.
Huh. Okay.
Which, to me, that says that if the state of Texas is trying to make a claim on my property, which actually never came from them.
It
does not exist by its own authority, and it was not introduced by its permission. It came from a previous foreign nation, and the superseding of that nation is the state of Texas, but it is governed by the law of the trust, which is written into the 1845 Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a provision there that protects the landowners that held land under the Republic or under Spain or Mexico, so that when Texas became a state, they couldn't just, you know, take their land from the the people that possessed it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It was already ceded into private hands.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, at what point then did the government of the day, to today's corporate government, when did they start laying claim to land? They don't. They really don't have a legitimate claim, but the tacit implication is that they have a claim if they can remove you from it.
Right. If they can tax you right out of your ownership of your land, then in what what ownership percentage do you have? I mean, if you can lose your land, even though it's paid for, then you really don't own it. You're renting it.
I would say then, exactly, yes. Then your claim to it is inferior to those who can take it away from you.
Right. And
there's only one way of correcting that I know of, and that's to go through the process that we're discussing now.
Right.
It may be an arduous process, but you've got to ask yourself at some point, at what point do I want to absolutely outright own what until now I thought was already mine?
That is a very important distinction. We all need to, you know, really look at that, because what is happening all across our nation is that people are being told that they cannot have a pond on their property that collects rainwater that is actually given to them mm-hmm. by God when He causes mm-hmm. it to rain.
Mm-hmm.
And they call that hoarding water or something, and they're not allowed to do that. And then other people are told that they're not allowed to have a garden. And other
right.
people are told that they're not allowed to have a pig with a black curly tail. And mm-hmm. other people are told that they're not allowed to have solar power and not be hooked up to the grid.
Yeah.
See, at what point are you willing to draw the line and say, this is my land, and you have no interest in it. You have no authority. You have no jurisdiction. You have no standing to even contest my land grant. What is interesting is in Texas, in the library of the University of Texas.edu,
uh-huh.
they have a statutory document section.
Okay.
And it was very interesting, because they repeated these phrases several times. And it talks about the records filed with the Texas Secretary of State statutory documents section comprise deeds to property, title abstracts, deeds of cession of jurisdiction, and other documents which legally transfer title of property and jurisdiction between the state of Texas and other parties, including private individuals, corporations, legal governments, and federal government of the United States. And it says that repeatedly all the way down. It was amazing to me when I saw it, because it goes hand in hand. When they divest themselves of title to the property, they also divest themselves of jurisdiction.
Correct.
And I've found that in American jurisprudence, in corpus juris secundum, in numerous court cases.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So then what what our counties are collectively doing, or states are collectively doing, is repugnant to positive law.
Yes. It is, and it's very unfortunate that people have not spent the time to really look at what the law actually says, and they have no clue. And if you don't read, then guess what? The truth can be hidden in plain sight.
Sure it can. That's the best place to hide anything.
Absolutely.
We're all given a choice. When we're brought into this thing called life, we're all given a choice. Are you going to be a spectator or are you going to be an active participant? Well, I was a spectator for a long time, and then I started reading law. And I got off the bench, and I started getting active. When I say started getting active, I started reading the law for myself and not taking it from the words of police officers who have never read the law themselves, not taking it from the mouths of attorneys who have, chances are, not read the same thing. A perfect example would be the transportation code. I use this for an example because I know for a fact that since I have read the law and I have read definitions in case law of transportation, I am not engaged in the commercial venture called transportation. Therefore, that body of code does not apply to me so long as I am acting in my own private capacity. Now, when you read that for yourself, you have knowledge. Knowledge is not power, folks. Knowledge is just simply knowing something. You can sit on your couch all day long knowing the truth, but until you put your action and your energy behind it, it's just simply knowledge. Knowledge only becomes power when you put your energy behind it. We're giving you knowledge. Now the question is, are you going to be a spectator or are you going to be an active participant in life? If you are willing to be a slave to your government, then you might as well just turn this radio broadcast off, go take your blue pill, and good luck with life. Myself, my conscience will not allow that. When I gained knowledge that there is remedy, I set forth to not only get that remedy for myself, but to also tell others that, hey, there's remedy out here.
Yep.
And Jennifer is doing a very, very good job today. Thank you very much, Jennifer, of conveying that remedy to you folks. So let's go. Okay. I'm carrying on here like this is something really, really important. Let's go back and look at some of the benefits of establishing or correcting your land patent. If you vote, you vote as a slave. You tell your elector who you want as your next slave master. Benefit. Go back to your constitution, your state constitution and the constitution for the United States of America. Who can elect? Only landowners. We're going back to that deed thing. If you have land by deed, you don't own it. So you're a voter. You're relegated to telling your elector who you want as your next slave master. You want to take over the Electoral College? Own land. Become an elector. Own land. There's one big benefit right there, political benefit. Another benefit, you own everything. Once you bring forward your land patent, you outright own every. You have what is referred to as allodial title to everything from the very center of the earth up through your property lines and literally out into space.
Let me kind of go over a little bit about allodial title.
Sure.
There were several different documents that I found, and I found them in looking at a court case called Wallace versus Harmstead. And it was a quote, and it said, "The American people, before developing a properly functioning stable government, developed a stable system of land ownership, whereby the people owned their land absolutely and in a manner similar to the king in common law England."
What was that case site?
Wallace versus Harmstead.
Thank you.
Harmstad. And it's 44 PA 492, and it's in 1863. And the rest of that quote says, as allodium means, or is defined as, a man's own land, which he possesses merely in his own right, without owing any rent or service to any superior. So I took that and I started looking up books of the law that actually had that quote in it. And what I found was there was a whole series of books. And what it started off as was a letter or a report from the commissioner of the General Land Office of the United States. And he made that report to the Secretary of the Interior. Now, this was in the year 1870. And what he said there was, the doctrine of tenure is entirely exploded. It has no existence, even in theory. Though the word may be used for the sake of convenience, it is with an accommodated signification from which the last vestige of feudal import has been eliminated. The individual title derived from the government involves the entire transfer of the ownership of the soil. It is totally, purely allodial, with all of the incidents pertaining to that title as substantial as in the infancy of Teutonic civilization. Following in the wake of this fundamental reform in our state land laws are several others which constitute appropriate corollaries. Now, that quote and a bunch more went from the Secretary of the Interior, who had received it from the General Land Commissioner, and he took that same information and he forwarded it to both houses, the House of Representatives. And then they forwarded it to Congress, and then it became part of the congressional serial set. And it's the third session of the 46th Congress, and they called it the congressional serial set, and that was in 1881. And they told me at the federal archives that this was the precursor to the Federal Register. And it ended up to be like 30 books. And on page 712 of the digitized book, it states, all the Slavish and military part of the ancient feudal tenures was thus effectually prevented from taking root in American soil, and the colonists escaped from the oppressive burdens. In short, for most purposes, our land may be deemed to be perfectly allodial or held of no superior at all.
Very interesting.
And then that also became part of the Organic Acts for the Territories of the United States. And so this was written in page 269. It begins the review of the Ordinance of 1787, which was the Northwest Ordinance, and the change of tenures and estates therein. And it states, free and unconditional alienation is now the rule of the national government in disposal of the public domain and encouraged by all the states and territories in land transfers. And it said, let's see, most of the feudal incidents of tenure, which in the colonies were of mere form, were abolished in many of the states after the Revolution and by the United States in the immortal Ordinance of 1787, which was Northwest Ordinance, the most progressive and Republican act ever performed by a nation in relation to the estates of her people. It made the individual absolutely independent of the state and the entire owner of his or her home.
So when was that written?
That was written in 1881.
Okay.
All of these things that she's reading to you come from her website in the,
yes.
the home page there.
When you look at law and historical books of authority, you can download them and read them for yourself.
Thank you. Jennifer, you've done a great job on this website. Thank you for putting this information out there. This is indispensable.
You're welcome.
Absolutely indispensable.
Fantastic
folks,
resource.
I don't care if you have a deed to land. I don't care if you rent. You're affected by this directly, not indirectly. You're affected directly. Every time someone loses land to a government entity, we the people lose a little bit more power.
Yep.
And every day we're losing ground. It's time we the people, not the public, but we the people got back on top of our business and set things back the way they should be. I've heard it said there's the way it is and there's the way it should be, and that's just the way it is. Well, that's a defeatist attitude. I don't accept that. I don't accept that. You're already defeated if that's your attitude.
Yeah.
Change only comes through pressure, and pressure can only be applied by the right people. Sun Tzu taught us in The Art of War that to vanquish your enemy, you've got to first know yourself and know your enemy. Folks, a lot of you, I'm afraid, don't even realize there's an enemy out there. The enemy is your government. They're the ones trying to take your land. They're the ones trying to steal your power. They're the ones who demand your energy. Is that not what an enemy does?
Yeah,
in my mind, that is not what a friend does. That's not what an ally does. That's what an enemy does.
Right.
So, if we are to ever live as a true free people, we've got to know who we are. Part of that is knowing who we are through the eyes of our enemy. I think Jennifer might be the first one to tell you that her enemies have viewed her as an insignificant flea on the back of a dog.
Right.
Would that be a fair analogy?
Yeah, I think Jennifer's.
Okay. So, fleas bite, don't they? Fleas can kill a dog if there's enough fleas on the dog. So, okay, I'll be
sure.
A flea. Give me a dog. We live in a beast system. If it is a beast system, you will never negotiate with it. You will never defeat it in open warfare. You will never reason with it. The only thing you can do to protect yourself and your interest in your property is to starve it to death.
Starve the beast.
That is your only alternative. Starve it to death. Anything else is a waste of your energy, and that's what your enemy wants you to do. Waste your energy on frivolous fights.
Yeah.
That's why they put so much of their energy back into fighting people like Jennifer, because they realize that she's onto something. God forbid she should have a conversation with her neighbors and discuss her success. That would mean the end of county revenue generation through extortion.
But, you know, you really have to look at the law as its original purpose was to protect land rights.
Yes,
and
now that's turned on us.
We have gotten so far 180 degrees different. I don't view the law as my enemy. I view it as being misdirected through really a miseducation or people that are just too lazy to read what the law actually says. But when you really look at it, say, for instance, you know, we all know about Thomas Jefferson's private letter that he talked about separation of church and state.
Mm-hmm.
And that separation was not intended to be the church being removed from government. It was from the government being removed from the church.
Yes.
So that the church could do the work of God without interference of the government. But there is also a very interesting letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to Edmund Pendleton in August of 1776. And he states in there the opinion of our lands, the opinion that our lands were allodial possessions is one that I have long held and had in my eye during a pretty considerable part of my law reading, which I have always found strengthened it. In other words, his study of the law of America stated that all land titles in America are allodial.
Mm-hmm.
And I've shown that in book after book after book, court case after court case, American jurisprudence, Corpus Juris Secundum, you know, it's proven repeatedly all the way through there. And, you know, they don't want to actually look at the law and state, okay, this is where I have standing to actually even contest your land title. They don't want to discuss their standing. They don't want to discuss jurisdiction. They don't want to discuss where they think that they might have an interest in your land. They just want to presume, and it's all done by wavering consent. And if you don't object, if you don't give them notice and time that they can bring a rebuttal and provide their superior evidence for interest in your land, then, you know, you really haven't given them an equitable solution. And we all have to give each other notice. And that's
we're getting back into the maxims of equity.
Right. Yes. And so what this is all about is giving notice and showing the law the way it actually states it, and then going into looking at relation back theories and principles. Whenever you talk about principles, you are talking about kind of in the same idea as a maxim. You're talking about principles. And in our law books, they talk about the principle of relation back. And what it is it refers to the laws that were in force when the land was granted. Are the land laws or the land rights that land is governed by? And so we have to kind of look at that and say, okay, we cannot superimpose today's understanding and today's politically correct views as laws that actually govern this piece of property that was divested of right and title back in the 1800s. Back then, it was the laws that were in force at the time that it was granted that govern the property. And
that's prior to the Articles of Incorporation and the institution of statutes versus positive law.
Right.
So then, in essence, you're saying that once you bring forward your land patent, your original land patent, you're taking your land out from under the jurisdiction of any statute. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Okay. So then your land is governed by the organic laws of this nation and state.
Right.
Organic right. law. What is organic law, folks? Organic laws are the Constitution and the amendments thereto, the Articles of Incorporation, I'm sorry,
Declaration of Independence.
Declaration of Independence and the, I didn't mean the Articles of Incorporation. I meant the, oh, dear God. Oh. I'll think of it here in just a second. It's on the tip of my tongue. If I could see it, I could read it.
In one of these, I have all of that written out. And let me see here. I think it may be on the rights versus privileges page. I'm not sure.
Confederate papers. Not Confederate papers. What was it?
Articles.
I'm getting close.
Articles of Confederation.
That might
yeah.
be. Yeah. Anyway, that's pretty much all there is to organic law.
Right.
Organic law is absent statute because it predates statute. So by bringing your patent forward, you're bringing the old law with you.
Right. Yeah.
Declaration of Independence, Articles of Confederation, Northwest Ordinance, and the Constitution.
There you go, Northwest Ordinance. And Articles of Confederation, that's it. There's your organic law, folks. That's it. So in equity, statute does not exist.
No. No, and I'm starting to head that direction more and more. I have found in 6 years of fighting with them about my land title that they really, really don't care about upholding the law, unfortunately.
No, they just do what they want.
What I have found is that they really like to go with policy and practice,
mm-hmm.
wave and consent. If
yep.
you don't know what your rights are, you don't have any. And they don't, they really don't want to look at what the law says. They want to just pretty much
collect money.
Go with, well, we've done it this way for 100 years. You know, why are you fighting me now? You
because
know?
You've been doing it wrong for 100 years.
About time to change.
Yeah.
Right.
Just because this is the way you do it doesn't mean you're doing it right, and I want it done right. You're my servant. Do it right.
Yeah.
They've actually come out and said it. What was the, I don't know if it was a Supreme Court judge or Circuit Court or whatever, but it was about the 16th Amendment, and he acknowledged that it was never ratified, never properly ratified.
Mm-hmm.
But we've been doing it this way for so long, we're just going to do it this way.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's in your face.
Oh, I have a. I found it. It's under the law tab, and then under the law tab, it has a subtab called the Organic Laws of the United States of America.
Yeah.
There you go.
That's it.
And yep. In there's an article by Al Adask. And he goes through all of these different
Al's a pretty sharp
organic
guy.
Laws. Yes. And he goes through the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, the Northwest Ordinance, and the Constitution of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an excellent article.
Perfect. Yeah, Al Adask is one very, very good legal researcher. I would separate Al by saying he is Al Adask is a legal researcher, not a legal theorist. There's a lot of legal theorists out there, folks. When I mean legal theorists, there's a lot of people that come up with these harebrained ideas and get other people to go out there and guinea pig on this stuff, and the other people wind up getting in trouble. This is
yeah.
why I say do your own research.
Right.
Right.
Don't take my word for anything. Anything we say is just a good starting point.
That's right.
Something
Absolutely.
Called due diligence. And anytime you start off on a legal process, due diligence belongs to you and you alone.
Right. Jennifer, one of the chatters in the chat room, Hal Anthony, he also does a radio show here, and he's very familiar with the workings of the law and such. He says Jennifer needs to find the theft by extortion and coercion statutes in your state, which is Texas, and have the county officials signing the letter making a claim for your property to show cause how, in absence of any evidence, that official is not committing four counts of felony theft by extortion and coercion through acts or omissions under color of authority.
Wow.
Ouch.
Ooh, I like that.
I thought you might.
I
really want to get Hal on the show with us sometime. He's very knowledgeable. You can find his podcast on the Real Liberty Media website there. From what I understand, Hal started out with the minors, defending some minors. They had some problems, and I'm not that familiar with the story, but I really would like to get Hal on with us to discuss all this stuff. He's very knowledgeable in all these things. He has gone further on to say the organic document creates the obligations and duties of government to the exclusive property possessor.
Yeah, I would
Makes
have
sense.
To agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, it's really interesting. I do have a taxation page here.
Uh-huh.
And I go through and I give you kind of my argument, and then I go through and give you a whole bunch of the original laws and things. And the original law that created the authority to charge property tax, it's really kind of interesting because it tells you who is to be charged this property tax.
Uh-huh.
And this property tax was not to be charged to men and women for their shelter from the elements. It was to be charged to businesses. And these businesses that actually created money and revenue
mm-hmm.
off of their land. Because, you know, you have to remember way back when, people may own 1,200 acres, but only 200 they could claim as homesteaded.
Right.
And
right.
in that 200 that was homesteaded, they were expected to earn a living off of their land.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you look at that, it tells you, it says, an act defining what money and property is subject to taxation or exemption, and the mode of listing the same. And when you look at that, you see that originally it was passed in 1876. Well, my land was granted in 1845.
Ah.
See what I mean? So
uh-huh.
this land law, or the laws that were enforced when the land was granted, had no exceptions, no restrictions. There was nothing that gave provision for them charging property tax on the land back in 1845. And the 1845 Constitution stated that all rights of men in action should remain in the exact same position as they were under the Republic of Texas as when they came under the United States of America as one of the several states. So when you look at that, it states right here, let's see.
That tells me the Republic of Texas is still recognized and still active.
It is, actually, because there's a Rule 56.
Rule 56 of Texas Civil Rules of Procedure.
Right.
It's also
and
reflected
that,
in the rotunda of the Capitol building.
Right. But in this Section 4 of this document here, this Laws of Texas, Chapter 156 through 157 of this Act, it states, the term person, whenever used in this act or in any other act regulating the assessment and collection of taxes, didn't just say property taxes, it said just taxes, shall be construed to include firm, company, or corporation. They define what the term, it's not what the word, it says what the term person means. And it states in there, or any other act. See, it covers all of that. So this is the law that gave them authority to charge tax in Texas. But it talks about who should be charged this tax and on what. See? So
yeah.
They have never proved, and this was actually carried over for years and years and years, over 100 years. And then it's just kind of like, forgot to be included in one of the last
updates.
What do they call that? Yeah, when they modify it. But that was in 1977 when they just forgot to put that definition in. But it never was repealed, so it's still in full force and effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's just missing out of sight, so that people that are trying to research all of this can't find it because it's not actually listed currently, but it's still active in full force and effect. And that's what gives them the authority and the jurisdiction and the standing to bring anyone into court is this particular law, because it was amended and amended and it was brought forward and brought forward all the way from 1876 all the way to 1977.
Yeah.
It's just not in there. It doesn't show.
Just to retouch the civil rules, it was Rule 53 of Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, special act or law. A pleading founded wholly or in part of any private or special act or law of this state or of the Republic of Texas need only recite the title thereof, the date of its approval, and set out in substance so much of such act or laws as may be pertinent to the cause of action or defense.
Right.
So, yes, the Republic of Texas is still recognized, still active, still in full swing. It's just nobody uses it.
Right.
Hal says revisions is the term you're looking for.
Right, revision. Mm-hmm.
There you go.
But they are only allowed to revise without substantive change.
Correct. But you and I know there's always a substantive change. Even moving a comma could be a substantive change.
Right. Right.
And that is a
well, when you look
point.
At this, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There is a case in point out there for the comma thing. I forget what it is. It's something to do with the traffic code, transportation code.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And try the Constitution as well.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
When you look at the website under law and under Texas, this is under taxation. If you look at the taxation page,
mm-hmm.
Clear down about halfway, it has the 1845 Constitution joining the U.S., and it has Article 7, General Provisions. And Section 20, it says, the right of property and of action which have been acquired under the Constitution and the laws of the Republic of Texas shall not be divested, nor shall any rights or actions which have been divested, barred, or declared null and void by the Constitution and laws of the Republic of Texas be reinvested, revived, or restated by this Constitution. But the same shall remain precisely in the situation in which they were before the adoption of this Constitution.
Hmm.
And then it talks about that the legislature shall have the power to protect by law from forced sale a certain portion of property of all heads of families, the homestead of a family not to exceed 200 acres of land, in value not to exceed $2,000, shall not be subject to forced sale for any debts hereafter contracted, nor shall the owner, if a married man, be able be at liberty to alienate the same unless by the consent of his wife, in such manner as the legislature shall hereafter point out. Taxation shall be equal and uniform throughout the state. All property in the state shall be taxed in proportion to its value, to be ascertained as directed by law. Okay, and we already said so many, I guess it was like 30 years later when this tax thing came up, it directed, you know, by law. Okay, except such property as two-thirds of both houses of the legislature may think proper to exempt from taxation. Hmm. And so, you know, the legislature shall have the power to lay an income tax. Of course, we don't have one in Texas. And to tax all persons, there you go again, pursuing any occupation, trade, or profession, provided that the term occupation shall not be construed to apply to the pursuits, either agricultural or mechanical. So that protects the farmer and people like that that grow our food.
Mm-hmm.
And then it talks about the $250 worth of household furniture, but that was at 1845. And then I have a like a conversion chart down here.
Mm-hmm.
The $250 worth of 1845 dollars would be worth $7,812.50 in 2015. And that's just in household furniture. And $2,000 in 1845 would be worth $62,500 in 2015 in land and improvements. Hmm. So, you know, there is a huge protection here that they built in to protect people from losing their property. And, you know, it was the intent by people that were registered to vote that they must own land. And the reason wasn't to penalize people to not be able to vote that didn't own land. That wasn't it. It was so that people that voted would never vote to have the taxes raised so much that they would lose their property by being taxed out of it.
Like what's going on today?
Absolutely. So they have given the right to vote to people that do not have any interest in it because they don't own any property. They're living in a, you know, an apartment. What do they care what, you know, homeowners have as obligations? They don't care. It doesn't affect them.
It does. They're not smart enough to understand how.
Right.
The apartment that they're living in, their landlord owns that privately. Now, yes, it is a venture capital. It's if you allow a government to raise your landlord's property taxes, guess who's going to be paying the taxes?
Right.
You. Your rent's going to go up. So, yes, you're affected.
Right.
Yep.
Very, very interesting.
Yes.
Okay, so to get back to process, once you've got everything filed, once you've got everything in place, you allow the 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, whatever, nobody steps forward and claims and blah, blah, blah. I would think that since nobody has stepped forward, like the tax office has stepped forward to say, hey, I've got a claim in this and it's worth $500 a year to me. This begs the question, and Jennifer, you're welcome to tell me it's none of my business. You don't want to put it out on air. That's fine. It's all well and good. But I've got to ask you, when's the last time you sent the tax office a check?
Oh, it's been probably 2 years, and that was because they were going to actually put my land on the auction block. And so the Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, I went in there and it was raining like crazy and they were all in the dark. The power had gone out. And I went out there and I told them, I said, I'm going to tender you involuntary payment of this. And it was actually written right on the bank check that it was an involuntary tender.
Made
of,
under duress, yeah.
Right, under duress and under, what do they call that? When you're put as slavery, what do they call that?
Oh,
peonage.
Peonage, that was it. It was involuntary payment under penalty of duress and peonage. And so they accepted it, they stamped it, received and everything. But then when they wrote me the receipt, which was later because their computers weren't operating with no electricity, they refused to document that. And so we went back and forth, email, and they refused to document it. But I have it on the check. And they stamped it, received. And so...
Then they accepted it.
Yes. They never
along
returned
with
it.
Its terms.
That's right. And so the terms and defenses, it was tendered pursuant to the terms and defenses that it was tendered under. And
so have they threatened you since?
Oh, yes. Yes, they've actually set me up for trial on the 28th of February.
Okay.
And so I'm kind of looking at, number one, if I should ask for a different court, you know, and do it under a complex case, which in equity you would do it as a complex matter rather than mm-hmm. case.
Right.
Or if I should go to the Supreme Court, because
you got to work your way up to that.
Well, you do if you're statutory. You don't if you're in equity. And
gotcha.
I'm starting to do everything in equity.
Yep.
Because I have found that I cannot find any relief in statutory. There's no relief to be found that I have found.
Yeah.
It's very, very frustrating when people really don't give a flip. And you go into court and the judge, who has an oath of office, and he is supposed to be upholding the Constitution and the laws of Texas and the United States. That is his oath.
Right.
And so you accept his oath of office on and for the record, and then you ask him if he has read your pleadings, and he says no. And so you say, would you like to read them now? No, let's just go ahead and proceed. Well, you know, I'm challenging jurisdiction. And he just lets the other party just proceed, and I'm sitting here, you know, objecting.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, you know, overridden, you know. And so when I get ready to, you know, give my evidence, he says, we don't have time for you to read your evidence into the court record. And I'm saying, but this is my defense. And he says, I don't care. I don't have time for you to read that whole thing into the court record. And I said, but this
are you
is
familiar with judicial misconduct complaints?
Yes. And
yeah.
They take 2 years to even get them to look at it.
Yeah.
And once they look at it, they really don't do a whole lot. They basically say, you know, we're going to give him a private censure. And then everything remains the same way it is.
Wonder if you can put a lien on his oath and bond.
I think you can do a, what do they call that? The bond is a risk management bond.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you give them notice, there's
the
a bunch of procedures. It has to be notice, and give them time to,
correct,
you know, respond. And then after that, you can put in a claim, I believe, but don't quote me on that, because people do get into trouble a lot.
Yes.
Putting liens on public officials. There's ways that you have to do it, and
That is exactly why we've got Texas Government Code Section 51.104 through 101 through 104.
Jennifer, one of the
back in the day, there was a group of secessionists that called themselves the Republic of Texas. Now, some of these guys that belonged to this group would go in to fight a traffic ticket or whatever, have their backsides handed to them, and in retaliation, they would put a lien on the judge's property, on his house, his land, his cars. They'd probably put a lien on his library card if they could figure out the number. But this was really starting to become an encumbrance and a hindrance to those seated in power. So those seated a little higher listened to the lobbyists and created this body of statute for the removal of fictitious liens through Republic of Texas-type pleadings.
But that's a double-edged sword, too, because a notice of lien is not the same as a lien that
Correct.
Is actually court ordered. So
Correct.
When you have not had your day in court and you've not been noticed properly and whatever and gone through the court process and had a
mm-hmm.
judgment against
mm-hmm.
you, then these wonderful IRS liens have no force and effect either other than they
That's
ruin
right.
your credit card because they are not truly a lien. They are just a notice of lien.
Right.
And so the problem is that the court clerks are so afraid of the IRS because, you know, of the way that they're run, that they will not actually follow the law.
Yeah.
And so we have an that. Issue there. But part of it is just really educating people. You know, we need to educate them and say, you know, can you please show me? And I find that if you ask questions, you know, you can make notices and things, but if you ask a question and say, you know, I'd like for you to show me where you're finding that, because, you know, I really haven't been able to find it, and I've looked and looked, and, you know, and you do it that way, you're less to be viewed as an enemy, and I really don't want to be viewed as an enemy or a belligerent. I try very hard
sure.
to keep things very positive, and I'm very friendly when I go in there. And I try very hard, but it's difficult when they really don't care what the law says.
Let me enlighten you to something. There's somebody a whole lot smarter than I am a long time ago determined that rights belong to the belligerent litigant. Rights belong only to the belligerent litigant. But you don't have to be rude to be belligerent.
I don't guess that I want to be considered a belligerent. I would like to be considered someone who actually knows my status, which has been corrected.
Good.
And, you know, I'm a private American, not mm-hmm. a U.S. citizen, because
Good
U.S.
Deal.
Citizen is pretty much determined to be a corporation citizen
Correct.
Of Washington, D.C.
Correct.
And I've never lived in Washington, D.C. I don't work in Washington, D.C. And mm-hmm. I really don't have anything to do with Washington, D.C. So
Try not to,
I'm
anyway.
Not a U.S. citizen.
Jennifer,
you know, I'm an American, and my estate is actually located in my birth state where my birth certificate was issued. So I am, it's kind of like Maddie Ross of Yale County in True Grit,
mm-hmm.
you know. I am Jennifer Ruby, and I am in, you know, of Phoenix, Arizona. So, you know, that's the domicile of my mother when I was born.
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer.
So, I don't know. You have to kind of look at all of these different nuances and But the main thing is that you want to stay as polite as, you know.
Courteous, cordial.
Courteous as possible.
Amicable.
And I find that in equity, you try to extend equity if you expect to receive equity. And so correct. You want to just basically state the truth in love and be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And, you know, if the court wishes to give you remedy, then you have to do it in an equitable fashion.
Correct me right. if I'm wrong, Jennifer, but courts of equity are governed by 20 maxims.
Yes.
Folks, if you want to get into this and know your enemy, or at least know the battleground.
Yeah, I would say the battleground.
Do a search for the 20 maxims of equity and become very, very familiar with them.
I have them actually on my website. Under the law tab,
mm-hmm.
at the very bottom, I have the maxims of equity. And when you look at this law tab, you'll find I have all of the Black's Law dictionaries 1 through 7, I think, under there. And they're all in PDF, in a PDF graph here. Mm-hmm. And you can download just the books that you want. I've perfect. Got Blackstone's commentaries. I've got mm-hmm. Bouvier. I've got the maxims of law, the legal maxims of law. I've got a lot here. I've tried to put everything that I can find.
A lot of our maxims come from Bouvier and Blackstone.
Right. They're right in the front part of the mm-hmm. dictionary.
We're down to about 8 mm-hmm. minutes here. Jennifer, Hal on the in the chat room here again has asked me to ask you or tell you this. Have Jennifer consider, if she's a defendant defending a patent against a claim of control, remedy of quo warranto for the judge to prove capacity, competence, and court establishment over the subject matter of a patent upon an alleged cause of a third party without interest committing felonies, fraud, and fraud upon the court?
I need to see if I can get all of these words of wisdom that he's putting into the chat and have it forwarded to me, because I'd really like to look at
it
very
right
closely.
And
Rob, can you copy and paste that into her Skype?
Yep, that's exactly what I'm doing. Just did.
Perfect.
Thank you. I really, really appreciate that.
Let me grab this.
Jennifer, we've got 6 minutes left. Is there anything that we have left out, or is there anything that you would like to add to today's conversation?
Well, I think that the main thing is to give people that are wanting to do this research as much ammunition as possible. And when you look at my webpage, on the home page, there's 2 main PowerPoint presentations. The first one is what I kind of went over when I was going over the documents that started in the 1870s with the land commissioner forwarding. And it also goes over the Greenleaf case, which talks about whatever is included is not excluded, whatever is excluded is not included.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is in this PowerPoint presentation. And then the second PowerPoint presentation, where it says continue here,
mm-hmm.
is just a little bit, it's a very simplistic overview of equitable expressions of trust and how it's the formation and expression of the trust. And
excellent.
If you'll notice here, too, I have a search engine by Google. And
that.
If you put any type of a search term in here and push go, it will search my entire site. And I've got all the meta tags and everything, and the robots go through here regularly. And so there's a lot of information that you can cut through the chase and just do a search here. On the website. And then if you look here under court case sites, there mm-hmm. is a ton of court case sites here. And a lot of them, I have actual links to the document, either in PDF or
I
in Word,
that.
Or a link to the Just Law or whatever, you know, case. Mm-hmm. And then there's a tab on jurisdiction. And that is very helpful, because when you look through here, it it tells you what the courts, a lot of the Supreme Courts, have stated as far as what your rights are with regard to property. And
it's good to know.
There's a lot of information. I've tried to put as much information, everything that I study mm-hmm. for 6 years, I've tried to put on here for free. So this is like getting,
bless your heart,
a ton of free information just, you know, handed to you here.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Fantastic resource.
Very gracious thanks.
Yes.
Yeah, and if you're interested in minerals and mining and things like that, you know, some people are interested in mineral rights and all that. Mm-hmm. I have a real good friend named Ron Gibson, and he's up in Oregon. And he is like the CEO of the second largest mining district. And he's given me permission to use a lot of his links and references that go back to his site. But they're all right here.
Good.
And then also there's a lady who is an attorney in La Porte, Texas. And
okay.
she does only mineral right litigation for people who own Mexican and Spanish land grants with the mineral rights. And
mm-hmm.
she helps to recover their mineral rights for the heirs of the Spanish and the Mexican land grants.
Right.
And so I've got information on her.
Very.
And
2 minutes.
Got information on eminent domain and trespass and some on water rights. When we were dealing with our county wanting to drill 10 wells that were 24 inches diameter, and they were going to pump out, I don't remember, it was like 2 million gallons, I don't remember, of water a day.
Yeah.
And they were going to just totally decimate our aquifer. I got very involved in water research.
I hate to say and,
water
rights
is becoming an increasingly more important issue.
We're out of time here. Thank you so much, Jennifer, for coming on today. I really
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It. You've been listening to the Smoke and Mirrors show, folks, with Jennifer Ruby talking about land patents. Thank you, Steve. Stay tuned. Coming mm-hmm. up next is The Bridge with Kira on rlmradio.xyz. Thank you so much for tuning in. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you, Jennifer.
You're welcome.